Okay, so this session is called From the River to the Sea, Free Palestine. And we're very lucky today to have two speakers, Reem and Omar, who are going to talk to us today about the history and the unfolding struggle of the Palestinian people to free themselves in the Middle East. I'd like to start, though, as we have been all conference, but I think we need to continue to do, to acknowledge that this conference is happening on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and that we pay our respects to their elders, both past and present. We acknowledge that the ownership of this land was never ceded, and that this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Just to remind people again that the bar upstairs will be open all weekend, and after the session, this session, we'll be heading up for dinner, so please stick around. There's a whole range of talks that are happening after dinner as well, a series of sessions, as well as tonight, a couple of exciting events, one of which is a radical walking tour of Melbourne University with local historian and radical Mick Armstrong, and also in the bar, a live music and poetry event telling the story of the 1930s German composer Kurt Weill. But I'll remind people again about that. But without further ado, because I know we're starting a little bit late, I might start with Reem Yunus. Now, Reem has been is a member of Socialist Alternative, is a Palestinian socialist, and has been active around the Palestinian cause for many, many years, and is going to introduce the session today. And then, obviously, keep some notes and have some ideas about things that you can contribute to the discussion after both Reem and Omar have spoken. Thank you.
Thank you, comrades. Can you all hear my voice? Okay. Well, how to enter or introduce a wound such as the size of Palestine? I felt while I was researching, I mean, of course it's in my heart all the time, but I had to research more for it for this time, but I felt that I'm entering the wound all over again, because for me it touches a nerve. It touches the nerve of the suffering of all the Palestinians, all the generations that I came from. For instance, my family is from the West Bank, and we had been in Kuwait for many years, and I was born there. But the problem is we wanted to go to Palestine, and we couldn't go back because of the defeat in 1967. And I can vividly remember the tears and the grieving in my parents' minds and talks and around me, and I can remember that my mother couldn't see her sisters for the next 10 years until we could enter Palestine afterwards as visitors. Okay, so Palestine is our wound, and it's the wound of all the Arab nations around us. You can't separate us from our Arab body. What I want to say is here, I'm not just Reem the Palestinian, but I'm here, Reem the Socialist. And I want to really emphasize how much we in the Socialist Alternative, as socialists, we stand on the side of the Palestinians. You cannot choose to be a socialist, a person who believes in human liberation and social justice, and not stand on the side of the Palestinian. Why is that? I want to go through it bit by bit. The thing is, the whole issue of Palestine is the issue of the whole creation of Israel in 1948 was actually the crystallization of the imperialist project on the land of Palestine. The Zionism had to establish Palestine to be their watchdog. For us, the Palestinians, it meant dispossession, oppression, ethnic cleansing. It meant for us to live in our land as a second-class citizen for the people who kept living there. Now, creating Israel means an attempted genocide on the Palestinian people. The linking of the Zionism in order to establish Israel with the imperialist powers that was at the time, firstly with the British Empire, that eased for them having settlements there and having a foothold there until they were ready to announce the Israel was the first step, and then becoming the watchdog for American imperialism after World War II. So I want to go and analyze every bit of that, because every bit of that will inform you that why we are on the side of the oppressed, why we are on the side of the Palestinians. Well, to begin and to cut the wound from one of its deepest depths, I won't say its heights, which is the word Nakba. Nakba means the greatest catastrophe. It entered the language now in English to say the word Nakba. Nakba of 1948 happened. They announced it exactly on the 14th of May, 1948. And the British mandate left Palestine officially the next day, 15th of May, 1948. What happened to make that happen? 1 year earlier, back in 1947, there was the United Nations gave the resolution 181, which is the known as the partition resolution, which actually sought to solve the problem of Palestine, when in fact they have actually created the problem of Palestine. The Zionists lobbied long and hard for that resolution to happen, and it happened because of them. The Arab League, which as we know, they are a league of dictators. At the time, they were still, cannot say it that obviously like now. So, yeah, so they lobbied actually against it. Because no one in his right mind back in 1947 would accept to give half of your house to someone who is a total stranger who wants to say, I want to make it my hometown. Well, so that resolution actually came into existence in the 29th of November 1947. And according to that, historically, the Zionists were given 55.5% of what is to be called now Israel. And the Palestinians were left with 44.5%. But the Israelis, since this happened, they had their own agenda. They wanted to seize as much land as they could. They had their gangs of the Haganah and Irgun, and they went on killing rampage into villages, towns, neighborhoods. In the end, they managed, through massacres, through their fear campaigns, through everything they've done against the Palestinians in order to evacuate that land. That land had to become clear of its inhabitants. They were a nuisance to them, these Palestinians, the indigenous people. And so the Zionists, by the time 14th of May came, they actually have bitten off, chopped off our body, our Palestinian body, 77%, much more than what the partition plan allowed them. What happened as a result of their killing rampage is a total of, and that took over like 6 months before 1948, and the next 2 to 3 years after. It totaled to 800,000 Palestinians who were expelled. And this 800,000 amount to 80% of the inhabitants of the 1948 Palestine. 530 villages were wiped off. 11 urban neighborhoods were emptied. Over the years, I got to know a few people from the 1948 Palestine, and I sometimes asked them about their own personal stories, and they told me that when they went back to visit, maybe because they had relatives there, And they went to the same area where they knew where their town was, or where their school was, or where their mosque was, or their church was. And they were horrified to see some churches and mosques changed into bars or stables for animals, or completely to the ground, wiped off to the ground. What remained in Palestine is just the few people who were stubborn enough, who wanted to stay and not leave to the neighboring Arab countries. It's about 140,000 to 150,000 Palestinians remained, and they now contribute to 20% of what is now known as the Israeli Arabs. And by the way, if anyone here says Israeli Arabs, I really feel a dagger to my heart. I just like to call them the Palestinians of 48. That's how we call them. Okay. Now, they have grown demographically, and they are 1.3 million Palestinians, almost. How did the Zionists manage to make Palestine into Israel in that almost quick period of time? Theodor Herzl, 50 years ago, said they want to build it within 50 years, and they have actually surpassed it by only 1 year, and they managed. They actually put it down into Chaim Weizmann had a long quote, which is along the lines of that we could do it through three things. 15% was the Ergon did the job, which is the gangs that went rampaging the people. The Haganah did 55% of the job. And the last 15% was to the psychological warfare, which is the fear-mongering. So, one of the things that you all remember is Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin is only one, but it was big in memory. Eyewitnesses of those who survived, the few who survived, tell their children, and thus it is in our folklore, that the Israelis, including Menachem Begin, who became one of the prime ministers of Israel in the later years, personally came and, you know, slaughtered these people. They slaughtered them. It doesn't matter if he's an elderly. It doesn't matter if it's a pregnant woman, and they will stab the pregnant woman in her belly. That's what happened, a full massacre to a full village. But it was enough to create that fear around the villages. And all these villagers, they had to run away. And the Israeli gangs were just following them. And my former mother-in-law used to tell me that when she had given birth to her child for only 2 days, and she had to carry him with alongside the other three girls who are still toddlers with her husband, and just walk and run and walk because there is the bombing and shelling around them, making sure that they are going towards Lebanon and not looking back and coming back. That is the amount of fear. And she told me that even some people, from the fear, some women carried a pillow rather than her own baby, just from fear, and just ran away. So we all have this in our folklore. Now, what happened is we have refugees because of that. 1948 had the first defeat of the Arab armies, which just were symbolic. But in the same time, the Palestinian people at the time thought, oh, the Arabs will liberate us. We're just going to Lebanon or Jordan to our relatives for a few weeks, and we'll come back. The Arabs will liberate us. Little did they know then that they will live until now without the right of return. The refugees now, these 800,000 Palestinians are 5.5 million. 5.5 million. They comprise of all the descendants of the Palestinians there. And so they lived in, not all of them were wealthy, very, very few layer was wealthy, but most of them were those who went with just the least they could carry. And they lived in refugee camps So I'll tell you, like in Lebanon, there is 12 camps at least. In Syria, there is 10 camps plus 3 unofficial sites. In Jordan, there are 10 camps. In the West Bank, there is 19 camps. In Gaza, or Gaza as you say it in English, 8 camps. This was the largest exodus in history, the largest refugee problem in history. And despite that, I know from people who visited refugee camps, and I know from one experience myself when I visited the West Bank back in 1976, and I went to one refugee camp next to Bethlehem, that these people are very dignified, very, very dignified. And they teach all this folklore of the Palestine issue into to their children. Some still have the keys, the old keys to their homes. My own mother-in-law still has the plans of the house where she just moved into like a few weeks ago, and then 1948 happened. So everybody has memories. We're talking about a life that has been uprooted. That is the size of what happened to us. So that's actually, if this is not ethnic cleansing and attempted genocide and oppression and all the above, then what is? I'm at loss, really. This is the refugee question, but we are not just refugees, and we never took things as victims. And my comrade here will go over the resistance, but suffice to say that I'm telling you, since the 20s and 30s, the Palestinians weren't silent. And it is known in our folklore that a peasant Palestinian would be happy, and his wife would let him, to go and sell his wife's gold, which is given usually to the woman in her upon wedding ceremony, in order to buy a rifle. Anything to fight. How can you fight a bigger army that is, you know, joining hands with the British imperialism? Okay. That was the main stage of our wound. The other stages just followed. There is, we called it Nakba, 1948. 1967, we call it Naksa in Arabic. It didn't enter your language, but I'm telling you, Naksa means the great disgrace. We, the Arabs, felt the disgrace. I was little when it happened, but when I grew older and I read the writings of poets and thinkers of that stage, it shows how much shaken the Arab thinkers at that time were. Why were we defeated for the second time? And this actually exactly gave America the confidence to be on the side of Israel, full stop. Because Israel actually proved itself in this, the so-called Six-Day War was actually nothing. We didn't really fight. We had these regular armies that we put our trust in. And so the Palestinian resistance, they thought to themselves, we have to take matters into our hands. But I won't talk about the resistance. I will tell you about our sorrows more and more and more. Because really, that is what makes our oppression still continue. It didn't stop at 1967, because at least at 1967, till the Oslo Agreement of 1993, we were under military occupation. Under the Geneva Convention, at least the Israelis had to provide water, electricity, services, everything to the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm not saying they're nice. I'm not saying far from it. The settlements were there, and they were increasing, but they didn't have the fig leaf that Oslo gave them. So the third stage of our pain and biggest wound is when the world became a uni-world order. America became like a god in the world, and the Palestinian right, alongside all the Arab dictators, they thought to their, and they told their people, well, see, we can't do anything against America. Who can stand against America? Let's just do negotiations. What did we get from Oslo? I'll tell you, more oppression. Here you go. The oppression. We gave them the recognition of Israel promptly, and in return, what we had is mere bantustans at the moment. How is that? Because having that Oslo agreement meant that these people worked for peace, and they gave us a two-state solution, a state for Palestine and a state for Israel. And you have to accept them that they are Israel. Well, what happened is the PLO now is effectively gone, and what we have now is Palestinian Authority. And that Palestinian Authority is meant to get that aid from America in return to policing our people, oppressing them and detaining them, the same dirty role that the Israelis have been doing. So they have that statehood, which means nothing, because they don't have actual state. What state do I have when I can't move around in my own country, in the so-called state? Let me go through a few things. The checkpoints, the wall, building the wall. You all heard about these things. So, the settlements and the increasing of the settlements. The four-year siege of Gaza, that's just to mention a few things. The treatment of the Palestinians of 1948 gone worse, worse and worse and worse. And I'll go through these points bit by bit. First of all, Israeli settlements, by the way, now they comprise 42% of the West Bank, of what is being given to us. How do we move around these settlements? I'll tell you. We have a lot of prohibitions, and we have a lot of checkpoints to go through. For instance, checkpoints. There are 75 manned checkpoints, and there are an average of 150 mobile checkpoints, plus 446 road obstacles. They can be slabs of concrete, they can be iron gates, you name it. Just anything to make you feel, oh, what's this life? We have, you have to go from here to there with certain permits, and we have a lot of places prohibited for us to go to if you are from a certain place. For instance, the Gaza Palestinians, they are forbidden to stay in the West Bank. They can visit, but they cannot stay. How the hell is that? Okay. West Bank Palestinians, they are forbidden entry to Gaza from the Eretz crossing. Eretz crossing is the crossing from the side of what is called Israel. Okay. So they'll have to fly somehow or sail or something to Egypt and go there, and if Egyptians let them. Okay. So that's actually dissecting the Palestinian body, more and more. Palestinians are not allowed to enter the Jordan Valley. Why? Access to water. Okay. All Palestinians are not allowed to be anywhere near the settlements. So there are the settlements that are actually a land grab and land theft of our certain peasants who were cultivating it for generations. And if the National Jewish Fund, it's called NJF, if it puts its hands on it, has authority, and nobody can tell it, no, I can't take you to court. Wait till 100 years, you will get nothing. Palestinians, for instance, they cannot go anywhere along the SEM line. SEM line is anywhere between the green line and the wall. They built a wall back in 2004, it's 8 meters high, 907 kilometers long. It has, by the way, 85 iron gates, out of which 25 sometimes open, occasionally open. Hooray! All right, so you can tell how happy we are. And between that wall and the same line, you can't go. I mean, tough if part of your family was part of that part, You can't go and see them. That's it. It's a forbidden place. Why? Security. No, it's not security. Because if it was only security and not land grab, I wouldn't believe that the wall will snake around in this way. The wall, the length of the wall is actually twice the length of the green line. The green line is what was given in the partition plan. And I have a map here that I made, and I can show it, which can show you the partition plan and how the Israelis actually appropriated more land in 1948 than the green line. That green line is what they have actually chopped off more than it in order to name it Israel, and left, of course, the Gaza under the Egyptian rule and the West Bank under the Jordanian rule. Until, of course, 1967. What about detentions or jails or something? I mean, I can't even begin to say how many people are detained, even if they are 12 years old. In a latest, really mind-staggering number, I read 750,000 Palestinians are in Israeli jails. 12,000 of them are women. Few thousands of them are children. They even deport some children to Jericho, which is somewhere close to the Dead Sea. So very far away from where they took them. And their parents will not know about that. And we don't know anything. They will just say, he was throwing stones. And after 1 week or 2 weeks, the poor boy will go home and all traumatized. This is democratic Israel for you. Yet the European Union, Obama, the American administration, they have nothing against Israel and against all its atrocities. We are well aware of Israel atrocities. We just remember the war in Gaza back in 2008-2009. And we are well aware of their attack on the flotilla, the group of ships that went and set sails in order to give aid for the Palestinians in Gaza and break the siege. Well, they won't say anything. Why? Because it suits them to have Israel as the apartheid state. Is there any wonder that we call it an apartheid state? Well, we know that apartheid state means racial segregation. What's happening is racial segregation. Look at their treatment for the Palestinians of 1948. Until now, they consider them second-class citizens, these 1.3 million Palestinians. Until now, there are a lot of laws that discriminate against them. And just since 2 years, since this most right-wing government, including, you know, the Likud, Kadima, and also the Lieberman, Victor Lieberman party, which is called Israel Baituna, which means Israel is our home. Since then, there are 20 more laws against the Palestinians of 1948 just to discriminate against them. Just the latest one was issued by the Knesset, which is the Israeli parliament, in the 22nd of March, 2011. And it states that that any mention of the Nakba by any Palestinian organization within the Palestine of 1948, I hate to say Israel, will be cut from funding. Okay. That's not maybe bad enough until you hear the second one. The second one, 6 days later, 28th of March, they issued a law that says any Israeli, of course the Arabs, they call us Arabs, not Palestinians. They can't even spell the word Palestinian. Any Arab who is convicted of treason or terrorism will be actually removed, his citizenship, Israeli citizenship removed. Well, the Arabs in the parliament, in the Knesset, they protested it because they knew it is actually meant at Hanin Zorbi, the Palestinian woman who is actually an activist, and she was a parliamentarian, and she went on the flotilla last year. All that is because of her. I find it very hard to believe that they will actually revoke the citizenship of any Israeli. Well, our wound is big. The Palestinians in 1948 suffer. The Palestinians in Gaza suffer. Just a few weeks ago, they had a lot of air raids from the Israelis against them on top of the siege. And there is a real possibility of Israel might wage a war against Gazans. And why is that? Simply because they feel more and more isolated. And they feel more and more at fear because of the Arab revolutions that's creating a lot of instability. They lost the best dictator they ever dreamt of, Mubarak. Mubarak, who held everything inside. And although the new leadership in Egypt didn't remove, actually, the peace treaty with Israel and didn't open the border, what if it would? That's their fear. So there is this possibility of an attack. And the Palestinians, of course, of what is called 1967 Palestine, which is under the Palestinian Authority, are still suffering until today of increased house demolitions, increased evictions, especially in the eastern part of Jerusalem that was taken in 1967, especially then. So, what is to be done? Well, we, the socialists, since we have proved that it is an apartheid state, I can't say anything except that this state is illegal. It's illegitimate. It has to be dismantled. What has to happen instead is to support the Palestinians into establishing their own state, their own democratic secular state on the whole of the historic Palestine, a state with equal rights of all, not supremacy for the Zionists only. And I have to go and leave you because I spoke too much. I just want to end it with one poetry that kept nagging in my head when I was preparing this talk, because as I told you, it just made me enter the wound all over again. It's about how they fear our demographic bomb until now and how they want us out of our land, even in 1967 and 48. So there was a poet, his name is Tawfiq Zayad. He said back in the 70s when they actually said the thing about the demographic bomb, هنا على صدوركم باقولة كالجدار مغني ونكتب الأشعار هنا باقون نملأ الشوارع بالمظاهرات وننجب الأطفال. What he said is that here we are staying on your chests like a solid rock wall. We are staying, making poetry, making babies, making demonstrations, filling the streets. Fantastic feeling.
Thanks, Reem. Thanks very much. I guess we want to hear a bit more about this poetry making and this street filling. So Omar Hassan is going to talk to us a bit more about that. Omar is one of the founding members of Students for Palestine here in Melbourne. He's Lebanese descent. He's a member of Socialist Alternative, a student at Monash University. And thanks, Omar.
All right. Thanks. Well, there is
Reem's only really begun to talk about the kind of atrocities that Israel has meted out to the Palestinians, but I guess I do want to start where she left off, which is the positive side of things, the resistance, and ultimately the solution to this tragedy. This session does, after all, get its name from the chant you may have heard at rallies, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And just out of indication, how many of you have heard that chant before, or maybe chanted it yourselves? Hands up. Cool, good to see. How many of you actually know that it's explicitly aimed at a one-state solution? Hands up. Oh, that's even better. All right, good. Well, I'm going to be making the case for exactly this kind of solution, and as well as that, seeing a strategy to hopefully making it a reality. Because I think, to put it simply, to understand what Reem has said, to understand the reality and the nature of apartheid Israel, really means understanding, actually, that is its very existence is a blight on humanity. That actually there can be no two-state solution on this basis alone. That this state, if it's allowed to continue to exist, it means cementing a state which Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, two people who, to be honest, are not very radical, say is far worse than apartheid South Africa. And that's why I think this solution should not be rejected. Point one. But there's more other ways in which it fails, because a two-state solution is pretty clearly not a solution for the Palestinians. I mean, all of you have the map, and I'd encourage you to look at that map and look at the slivers of land the Palestinians are being offered as a state. Because it's pretty clear this is not a bloody state. It's nothing. It's a chimera. It's a fig leaf. It's a strategy, and it has been over and over again, for the Palestinian leadership to accept less and less and less and give up more and more and more. And I think Ali Abu Nima, who's the editor and founder of a website called Electronic Intifada, put it very nicely. He said, "The recognition of a Palestinian state under Israeli occupation would certainly solidify and perpetuate the privileges and positions of unelected officials in the Palestinian Authority, while doing nothing to change the conditions or restore the rights of millions of Palestinians, not just in the territories occupied in the 67 war, but within Israel and in the diaspora." And I think that's pretty much summing it up. And I think as we reject the idea of a two-state solution, I think immediately we need to reject the idea that talking, negotiating, bargaining with Israel has anything to offer the Palestinians whatsoever. Well, because the first reason is these talks have only ever focused on the so-called two-state solution. That alone is enough to denounce them, really. But there's more. There's far, much, much more. I'm not sure how many of you have seen the documents published by Al Jazeera recently called the Palestine Papers. Because these documents show the reality. They're like WikiLeaks about the negotiations that went on between the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis. And they show in excruciating detail how much the Palestinian leadership were prepared to give up. They prepared to acknowledge Israel's right to exist, to abandon the rights of any refugee to return back to anywhere in Palestine, be that the West Bank or Gaza, or the actual, you know, so-called state of Israel. And they abandoned the right to even control their own laws. You know, one of the Oslo Accords says, "We grant Israel the right to censor or veto any laws that we will introduce in the future." This is going to be the so-called second state. And so I think we have to see that these negotiations were always going to be a farce, because if you look at the power structure in the region, it's pretty clear Israel is one of the largest military powers, backed to the hilt by America. The Palestinians, you know, to put it crudely, are a few refugees. And so I think more than enough energy has been wasted in talks about talks about talks about the possibility one day of having talks. It's a waste of time. And for the Palestinians, it's been a total distraction and has led to demoralization. And so because of the fact that not once in 63 years or 64 years it is now, has Israel ever decided voluntarily to stop being a racist monstrosity, I think it's actually voided its right to be consulted on what we do. And so I think we need no more conversations. What we need is to confront Israel and to actually defeat it in its totality and to replace it with a secular democratic state. And there are many who agree in principle with this kind of solution, but then they ask, well, how do we get there? You know, it's pretty tough. You know, in a way, we are confronting the military machine, one of the largest the largest in the region. We are confronting, in essence, America, because Israel is, as many describe it, the 51st state. But I think we have to say that precisely because the Palestinians have been oppressed and marginalized and, you know, tried to be ethnically cleansed by these forces, actually the Palestinians have resisted, and they've been some of the most radical in their resistance in the entire region throughout the last 70, 80 years. And I want to talk a bit about this now because I think it posits some lessons in terms of how we go forward today. The first really major flashpoint, I think, occurred in 1936, in April 1936 to be precise, where tens of thousands of Palestinians organised a general strike against Zionism and British colonialism. Now, this strike went on for 6 months. It was incredible. It was everywhere. Every single Palestinian pretty much participated in the strike. And actions included strikes by Palestinian workers, as you'd assume, but also boycotts of British and Zionist goods, refusals to pay rent and tax, and a host of other things. And basically, I guess to put it in today's context, it would be like having Tahrir Square in every village, town, and city in Palestine. But then after 6 months of this inspiring struggle, the whole thing was just round up overnight. It ended. And before, not a single demand had been won, not a single promise had been made by the Israelis or by the British. And what happened was, and this is an important lesson for the future, is that the Palestinian elites decided to sell out, that enough was enough. The struggle had gone far enough, and there was time to stop and talk. And they were right to be concerned, because the things they said to each other in secret was that it's gone too far. People are beginning to demand things. They're beginning to demand our power. They want to take our land, our wealth, for themselves as well. And one Arab historian describes how the masses' anger and violence in this period were directed as much against Arab landowners and brokers who had sold the land to the Zionists in the first place, as against the mandatory power, i.e. Britain. And unfortunately, after these peace talks, you know, were begun by the Palestinian elites, the movement never really reached the same heights. You know, it retreated. Some kept up the struggle in a guerrilla war, but this did not have the same mass element and therefore the same strength. And I'm sad to say this basic narrative of incredible, inspiring struggle of the Palestinians who have very little to fight with except their own bodies and their own blood, and yet the betrayal of the Palestinian leadership has happened time and time and time again. The first Intifada springs to mind, this incredible uprising, the War of Stones in 1987, as it's called, which is really a bit misleading. I mean, the Israelis were using helicopters, machine guns, tanks, but the Palestinian children were using stones. And they read stories. There were obviously strikes and protests and boycotts and so on. But there are stories of just thousands of Palestinian workers refusing, walking out of their jobs, refusing to ever work for the Israelis for a period of like 4 years. And you can imagine the kind of personal privation that would have led to. There are videos on YouTube where you can see Palestinian children running up to tanks, throwing stones, and then running and hiding behind corners as the Israeli like literally fired on them with live bullets and machine guns. And once again, in this case, actually, the Palestinians organized incredibly democratic popular committees, which actually maintained and distributed food and resources in the territories, and actually planned political resistance as well. And many of these committees were founded and led by women, which puts pay to the idea of the, you know, veiled, apathetic, Oriental woman. But again, the Palestinian elites, a different set this time, led by Yasser Arafat and the cronies in Fatah, which was a resistance organization, well, it used to be a resistance organization, began negotiating the Oslo Accords. And I think, you know, Reem has touched on them, but I just wanted to add one more thing that I already said earlier about the fact that Israel retained the right and the Palestinian leadership agreed that it could veto any future decisions in the so-called state. And I think the reason for this betrayal and the reason for the betrayals that have happened before and since is that the leaders of Fatah were not that fundamentally different to the leaders of the strike and the landowners in 1936. They were filthy rich, and fundamentally they were committed to preserving that wealth at all costs. And confronting Israel, organising a grassroots struggle to seriously do that, would have required organising the kind of, and unleashing the kind of power which would threaten themselves and threaten their own wealth. And so they used the Intifada, this incredible show of inspiration, just as a bargaining chip, you know. Here, we've got the gun, talk with us or we'll continue to hurt you. And the Oslo Accords followed. And so, given this period of Oslo, given the demoralization that ensued, I think it's no surprising that the Palestinians exploded again in 2000 with the second Intifada. And although there are many, again, interesting features about this Intifada, I think it's worth looking at the main political outcome of it, which was the rise of Hamas as the main kind of resistance organization in the Palestinian, or the land that should be Palestine. Because Hamas present themselves these days and are presented as fundamentally different to Fatah. They're militant, they're crazy, they're extremists, and so on. And, you know, the positive version of that is that they are actually committed to resisting Israel and committed to achieving a free Palestine. You know, that slogan is actually a Hamas slogan originally. But I want to argue that they actually have much more in common with Fatah than they do indifference. Because Hamas's leadership is drawn from the same wealthy people. They're funded by, you know, millionaires in the Gulf. They're leading members of doctors and lawyers and so on. And they're fundamentally committed to the status quo. And for all these reasons, that although Hamas is willing to engage in, you know, resistance, in armed gunfire and so on, they're actually not committed and do not endorse particularly the mass popular upheavals that have happened in the past and are happening today. So, for example, during the war on Gaza, you know, this siege on Gaza, which was magnified by the war, not once did Hamas say, open the bloody border to Egypt. Not once did they call on the Egyptian people to march to the border and open it themselves, a very realistic demand at the time. And there's other evidence as well. You know, Hamas's leader, Ismail Haniyeh, who's an elected PM, actually, although he's not able to be a PM due to the kind of corrupt PA, has offered Israel a long-term truce if only they would grant a mini-state within the 67 borders, which is basically Fatah's position in the 1980s. They didn't sell the two-state solution as a permanent solution. They sold it as a step towards getting more. It's the same thing. And I think the reason for this is that people from these classes, the middle and upper classes, cannot, be they secular or Islamic, are not going to wage the kind of struggle that is needed to confront Israel and ultimately the imperialist webs that prop it up, that have created it, and that continue to support it. They're more interested in finding a place within the so-called, you know, international community than they are in confronting it, which is what would be necessary. And so actually, only socialists can have a strategy for liberating Palestine, because it's only we who are consistently opposed to imperialism and to capitalism. And so, they will need to require to challenge these structures in order to have any success. But the reality is, unfortunately, that Palestinians themselves, I don't think, have this kind of social power. You know, they're isolated into the bantustans that you can see on the maps. They're monitored constantly by the IDF and the PA these days. And simply put, you know, the reality is Israel's excluded them consciously. And so they don't have the kind of power that, for example, black workers in South Africa did, because they were the ones, after all, who made the most damaging impacts on that apartheid structure there. But I think the Palestinians do have an advantage that the South Africans never had. And that is the loyalty, the support, the solidarity of tens of millions of people around the region. You know, it is impossible to now count the number of people who felt solidarity with the Palestinians in that region. I mean, I was brought up, and my dad who said, I'd rather die than ever see Israel stable and secure. And I, you know, at that time I was like, come on. But that's the truth, and that's how a lot of people feel. And that's been bred into our generations of people. And yet every time there's solidarity actions in the Middle East, they're oppressed by the leaders themselves. These countries who stand up and say, we're pro-Palestinian, we hate the Israelis, blah, blah, blah. Fundamentally, they have been the problem. Because they both benefit from them. Often they have secret ties with Israel, but definitely America. But also they know their own stability, their own rule is threatened constantly, as we've seen so joyfully in the past months. And so they've really been the barrier to a successful struggle for a free Palestine in the past. But you all know the story. This is not any year. The people of the Middle East are rising up. And since January, two dictators have been overthrown. Seven cabinets have resigned, and 15 countries have seen protest after protest after protest. And these dictators who've held things back for so long are beginning to fall. You know, in Egypt, although the revolutions are not primarily sparked by solidarity, actually the political question of Israel and Palestine is one of the first things that comes to people's mind. And so in Egypt, they've seen video clips of people chanting, Salihuna, Salihuna, ala Gaza, Akhiduna, which means, Amas, Amas, take us to Gaza. And that's, yeah, that's right. But the reality is, though, that at the moment, the leaders of these revolutions are not going to take the people of Egypt to Gaza, because they are not have any interest in confronting imperialism. They are, you know, the Egyptian military clique, which has run the country for 40 years, is now running it again. They have no interest. They've actually reinstated the peace treaty explicitly. And even the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, you know, known and feared as an extremist, oh my God, organization, they've been pretty much silent on the question, talking about potentially organizing reviews and so on if they get elected. And so what needs to happen is that the liberation of Palestine, and out of these revolutionary struggles, we need to see a political leadership built which is actually anti-imperialist, anti-Zionist, and anti-capitalist. And there's no reason why this can't happen, because there's been built in the past in the Arab world. In 1958, 1 million people in Iraq were organized by the Communist Party. 1 million people. And they toppled a British-backed government then. And you can see in the Middle East today that the revolutions themselves have a dynamic which pushes forward constantly, that the people are not going to be satisfied. The military will not deliver and bread and freedom and all the things that they need. So the possibility is there. And I think it's a real tragedy that in this situation, it's the Palestinians which are actually lagging behind in these revolutions. And I think it's the leadership that is to blame, not the people. I mean, Fatah, on one hand, God, they support Mubarak. So when the revolution started in Egypt, they organized mini protests in the West Bank of like 30 people, 40 people there, you know, probably their family members and hacks, to come out and say, we support Mubarak. That's Fatah, right? So who cares about them? But Hamas, unfortunately, Hamas in many ways is the bigger problem, because they have the possibility, they have the potential to mobilize people, and they have not done so. In fact, rather than kind of calling on the people of Egypt to rise up, to march into Gaza, as they themselves want to do, to break the siege, Hamas has actually unilaterally maintained the siege. You know, in the revolution, all the guards left the border crossing. They just went and participated in the revolution or whatever. But Hamas itself maintained the siege. And Hamas has since organized deals and promised to talk with the Egyptian military regime. And basically, Hamas is interested in playing the game of international relations, because they too want to run a capitalist state in Palestine, be it Islamic or whatever. And at the same time, there have been, you know, these resistance actions that have been going on in the Gaza. We support them, you know, defending against Israeli incursions and so on. But I think we have to see, like, firing a few rockets is pathetic. It's not going to liberate Palestine. It never has. It's just symbolism. And I think the Palestinians deserve much more. They deserve the revolutions in Cairo to be revolutions in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in the West Bank, and in Tel Aviv. Okay, so no one is saying that this struggle for a free Palestine, for a democratic, secular, liberated Palestine, is an easy one. As we've seen, Israel is extremely well-connected and well-supported. But 2011, we have to say, is the year of the Arab Revolution. And those of you who were here yesterday would have seen the heroism of the people of Bahrain, of Syria, of Yemen, of Egypt, and so on. And these revolutions are continuing. Just this morning, I read in Syria, hundreds of thousands of people demanding an end to this brutal regime, Hafez al-Assad or Bashar al-Assad now, they're all the same, father and son, who've been in power collectively for about 50 years. They're demanding the end to these things. And what do the regimes respond with? Bullets. But I'm pretty sure, as one report said, that the critical mass has been reached, the revolution will not be silenced. In Egypt as well, another demonstration marched on the Israeli embassy, burning Israeli and American flags as they went. And we've said for years that the road to a free Palestine will require the participation of Egyptians, as the road must run through Cairo. But it seems like this year, the people of Syria, of Lebanon, of Jordan, of Iraq, of Yemen, of everywhere, Morocco, Algeria, they want to be part of it too. And so precisely because of these revolutions, the road to Palestine has never been clearer and we've never been closer to seeing freedom.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, Palestine.